Hello and welcome to the Saints Score on all of your good podcasting platforms. It's episode 154 and we're here to react to the Everton game as well as preview the upcoming trip to Manchester City. We don't have Ollie this week. He says he's in Amsterdam, but I think it's because I battered him on fantasy football this week, so he's afraid. But what we do have, we have Jamie and we've got Mikey and a trio that I don't think we've had in quite a long time. Jamie, how are you doing this week? And you know, what
I guess that's a very good point, that Harry Tizard. We've had this last three in a while, but I've been a quiet week, obviously, since moving back home. But I drove a car for the first time in a long time, which I'm quite happy with, considering my driving course coming up. Wanted a bit of practice before I see the instructor, you know, so make sure I'm ready on the roads.
Great stuff. Mikey, what's been going on? And I heard you've created a new Twitter account as well.
Ooh. Yes, I have. Yeah, it's I believe it's Mike_Maidman. Basically, I got bored and made something on Tableau. And feel free to check out. I'm sure it'll be discussed during the podcast, to be fair, because I'm guessing that segment's going to come up at some point. But no, apart from that, it's been quite a chilled out week. Today, eye test today. When's the last time that you guys had your eyes tested?
I've never had my eyes tested.
You've never had your eyes tested? Fair enough.
Is that a normal thing? I don't know.
It's normal for me. I mean, the last one I had was 3 years ago because I got told that today by Specsavers. But my eyes are fine now. I don't know if I was just very tired the last time they got tested, but I had one eye that was long-sighted and one eye that was short-sighted. And now I've got one eye that's slightly long and the other one is normal. So, yeah, I don't really know what's going on. My eyes are a bit weird, but they work. So that's the important thing.
Yeah. Well, a lot of Saints fans, some of them, they're short-sighted and some of them like the longer picture as well. A lot of people have been questioning Ralph Hasenhüttl after this recent Everton 2-1 defeat. And I'm going to ignore Jamie for a second because, Mikey, you were the only one of the three of us that were at the game. So can I just have a bit of an overview? What was the feeling around the stadium before, after, and all that good business?
The general feeling of the game was it was a little bit drab. Wasn't a very high tempo game in the first half. And I think I turned to my mum and said, there's a reason why these two teams will be towards the bottom this year. And it's because there were no chances being created whatsoever. It was quite a drab game. And as soon as the second half came along, Aribo scores early, everyone's enjoying it, everyone's having a lovely time for about 30 seconds, and then 5 minutes later we're 2-1 down, everyone's sort of turning going, what's going on here? But there was quite a lot of like backing of the lads throughout the game. It didn't really turn sour or hostile because we were on top for the last 25 minutes or so. At the end of the game, there was obvious disappointment and your average, that there were some boos around the ground and all that sort of stuff. But to be fair, the last 25 minutes were quite promising. Like we had a real go at it, but I've got something else on that where we seem to be performing well when we go behind. And that's not a good trend because it usually means we have to concede a goal. So yeah, but like the overall feeling of it was that we weren't good, Everton weren't particularly good. We had a really bright last 25 minutes, but it's a positive, but then also not a positive because we've seen that what 7-8 times before this season, like already, and we've only got 8 or 9 games done. And it's disappointing not coming away with a clean sheet, but yeah, that's sort of my overall feeling of the game.
Jamie, what were your general takeaways from the match?
Well, I was actually reading the live text stuff on the way up because I was on the train when the thing was going on. And it was just like Everton were absolutely dominating the first half. At least what it felt like what reading along with the game. But it felt like a very, very meh game because when even watching the highlights, they skip so much. Basically, one clip of each tired attacking and skip straight to the goals. Like, shows how boring the first half was. And you could argue the second half was exciting with the three goals, but it's just an exciting for like 2 minutes for a Saints fan.
See, I watch the extended highlights on the Saints YouTube channel, as I always do, just to refresh my mind. And I looked at the first half, Mikey, it felt like we were quite busy, especially with Stuart Armstrong. But like Jamie said there, not much in product, not really anything in the final third going on testing Pickford. It just felt very fast-paced, a bit busy, but no end products.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, you could say it's busy. You could almost say, like, pundits will go, it was a midfield battle in the first half, but that just means it's drab. Like, not really much happened. No one could break each other down. Everton were very compact in the way that they played. Frank Lampard obviously just went, right, we're protecting the box. So back four were nice and narrow between the 18-yard box. You had a really compact midfield three. Wingers tucked in. They came back. Morpie was a little bit isolated, I'd say. But he was his same busy self that you usually find Neil Morpie being. So that's all how Everton set up. And I thought we went back to the 4-2-2-2. Pressed well-ish. We weren't like amazing at our pressing, but sometimes you did catch them out a little bit in the first half. Everton were time wasting in the first half already. They were looking, if they could come away with a point, they would be quite happy with it. So that's what that feeling was like as well. But yeah, it was a game against Everton. You both sides are struggling for form and points and everything like that. It's a tricky game, and yeah, that was just sort of my reflection on the first half. It just wasn't very good. Like, neither side looked like that they could break each other down, and to be fair, the only time that they did was Everton only looked like they could break us down in the first five minutes that they did. They didn't look great like during the game. So I think that's like another disappointing thing, is that the last three fixtures we've played teams that are going to be in and around where we are, and we've lost all three. And it's showing similar trends to seasons before, where we're playing against teams who are going to be between that 16th to 7th region that seems to be the Premier League right now. And we're not getting results against the ones that we should be getting results against.
Yeah, like it says, loss against Wolves, loss against Aston Villa. Maybe this is the most promising, if you could call that, out of the three. I'd say Everton are mostly the team on the up. I think they're unbeaten in their last six. So they're not a team that, you know, you look at last season, you know, they massively underperformed. Don't get me wrong, they've had a poor start to this season, but have really, you know, turned it up a bit. Something you pinpointed before the game, Jamie, in one of our little group chats, was that we had seven new players started, you know, a full debut for Ainsley Maitland-Niles, a couple other people in there. Larios had his full debut. What sort of impact do you think that has on the team when at the start of the season we had 11 players that all started, 10 because Bazuna was in goal, but the 10 outfield players I'm pretty sure were all here last season against Tottenham. We lost 4-1. That's quite a big change round for that to be now seven of the starting 11. And then the players that started that are already staged, you know, the Walker Peters, the James Ward-Prowses, the Chadhams, they're the obvious core players. So it feels like a lot of things have switched around in quite a short period of time.
Well, I think it's how, if you were on that bench, like most of them were against the Villa, you'd be annoyed if you weren't starting. I think that Ralph gave him the opportunity because of the international break. He worked with those players and gave him the chance to shine. But I think when you're changing that many players, it just can't necessarily work. Because, I mean, yeah, we did go 1-0 up, which is great. We didn't concede in the first half. Not bad for us. However, it's just there was no end product because no one has the form of playing with each other. Yeah, Joel Aribo's individual talent, because admittedly he's one of our best players now. Apart from that, you can't change seven players around and expect it to be a good result. But feel free to tell me I'm wrong, Mikey.
Well, before Mikey interjects, just to add that seven new players, but six changes against Aston Villa. Is that panicking? Is that what he feels like is best? Does he feel that he's under pressure? So, you know, these players in the previous game didn't attack, didn't have any level of intensity. So all the players that are on the bench, chuck them on and see what happens. What, like Jamie said, what do you feel like?
I think me and Harry had a call after the game, and I was saying in the fact that I compared this game to Leeds, in the fact that against Leeds you looked at the end 25-30 minutes where we went back to a 4-2-2-2. We had seven outfield players who had played that system before. And then you look at the end of the starting lineup today, seven new players who hadn't played that system before. When Ralph came out of the Leeds game and started talking about DNA, and that's what we always go back to, it's our DNA. It's like, if we're struggling, that's what we're going to go to. It's not in seven of these players' DNA because they haven't played that before. He talked about Ainsley Maitland-Niles still struggling during the international break. He looked lost during the game. I felt really sorry for him because he didn't look like he knew what he was doing. As much as Jamie said that Joe Aribo got the goal, and yes, it was a really good goal, like good piece of skill, managed to wriggle it out of his feet and finish the ball really nicely. He was going inside a little bit too quickly for my liking. When like the ball would be played into one of the central midfield three, he would try and nick it off of Drisagana Gay. Gay would just bounce off the fullback, play it down the line. And all of a sudden, Larios, the poor 18-year-old, is on a 1v1. Like, it was very simple things, like, in the system that obviously players just didn't get. And that's understandable. That's completely understandable because they've never really played the system before. And it's understandable from Ralph's point of view because they're still learning it. So, of course, it's not going to be perfect. But, you know, like, it got better as players came off the bench. Adam Armstrong, Elianuzzi, I know he only had two touches of the ball, I'm pretty sure. Perraud, when he came on, he looked really good. He got the most dribbles into the final third for us during the game. And he played, 25 minutes maybe? Not even that, 25 minutes, half an hour. Like, he looked direct. He looked like he wanted to get down the left-hand side. But, of course, he's still recovering from an injury. So there's lots of, like, little bits and pieces that are forming together to form this performance. Like, so you could just break it down and say, oh, it's a really bad game. But once you start breaking things down and going, well, there's seven new players, most of them haven't played this system before, they're all still learning, like, it's becoming understandable why this performance was like that and why the board are more willing to give Ralph time than some of the fans are.
Yeah, we'll go to, you know, Ralph Hasenhüttl confidence after we, you know, have a look at all of the games so far. But we go into halftime 0-0, and then 4 minutes afterwards, get Larios. He wins the ball back. I think it was, like you say, Gray that, you know, lost it. He bursts into the final third, lays it off to Adams, who cuts it towards Aribo, who sort of digs it underneath Pickford. Maybe he could have done better. We don't care because we're Saints fans. So if it goes in the net, we are not fussed. Jamie, do you think at the moment, my only concern is that Aribo looks like he's the most clinical man in front of goal that we've got. When he's on the pitch, it feels like he's always causing that sort of issue. You know, how impressed were you with that finish? But also, you know, you look at the others and think, you know, if you could just finish like he could, we might not be in a bit of a predicament after eight games.
I mean, when you wear the number seven shirt, Harry, you've got to take off the previous players.
Yes. Exactly.
And
exactly
get the finishing that from Matthias. But on a more serious note, it's just, I think he is such an underrated signing because it's what he signed for, what, five? Was it less or more?
Like, six, 8 million, something.
Yeah, something silly. And the fact that he's doing this in the Premier League and performing at this level, it's just such a shame to see that no players around him can replicate that, spending, 20 million on Che, similar amount on Armstrong, and then probably, goodness knows how much we'll spend on next striker that'll fail. It's just, well, how come this brilliant footballer we signed for nothing can't perform like anyone else? It upsets me.
this is something that really intrigued. That point really intrigued me. Like, I had that exact thought at the end of it. It's like, you sign Che Adams, but you go, oh, Che Adams isn't built to be a striker. He scored 22 goals in the Championship. Same with Adam Armstrong. Mm. He scored 25-plus goals in the Championship in a season. These are good strikers. These are strikers who know how to put the ball in the back of the net. So that's, like, another thing that I'm going to advertise the Twitter again. Another thing that I'm going to be looking at and I'm going to post out is that I've had a look at, like, the shot distances that teams are having and, like, what the expected shots are. Like, how good are the chances that we're creating and what the distance of that shot is, and then compare that to the league. And it's interesting because we don't actually have a bad shot distance. You think, like, very obviously, but very simply, if you have a shot close to the goal, it's more likely to go in. So you want your shots to be as close as possible to the goal. So We've got our shots between like 15 and 16 yards, which isn't too bad, but we're not creating good opportunities from that. And that you can break that down to a little bit of nervousness, I think, a little bit of indecisiveness, like, because you've got a squad that lacks confidence at the moment, obviously. With not picking up a win in a little while now. And what, how many wins, Tiz, you'll know this, how many wins is it in our last 20 odd games or whatever it is?
Not many. I think what, 12 points out of 60.
Okay. So you're talking four wins, basically.
Yeah.
That we've won for a while. So this is a squad that lacks confidence. And I think it's probably down to like too many touches on the ball. And this is the, another point I was going to make on the Everton game was that, so have, you guys haven't watched this, but my perspective of it was that, especially in the first half, first 45 minutes, and probably until we conceded the goals, we looked worried to lose the ball because we looked worried to lose the game. That, and that's not going to breed success because, like, even like Stuart Armstrong, I'm so used to watching him pick the ball up on the turn, look for a pass, not like dally with it, not like take two, three touches more than he needs to. He usually releases the ball when he wants to release the ball and he feels confident to do so. But in the game, he didn't do that. He didn't like play at the high tempo that we used to seeing Stuart Armstrong do. Like a lot of the actions on the ball from the players took two or three touches more than it actually needed to. So that's why the tempo of the game really slowed. And I think that's why like Adam Armstrong shot past Jordan Pickford. I know he had to like adjust himself, but surely you take, if you're a striker in confidence, you take that first time before the defender can try and get across and block it. Or like Jordan Pickford can recover from his misstep and make a save. Like those are sort of your little bits where you go, a confident player does that first time, and we're not doing that. So even though we're creating good distances to chances, we're not actually creating good chances because we're not confident enough to do that bit. So yeah, like that's like your main issues are that we're creating chances in good areas, but not necessarily. Creating good chances, and we're conceding chances and conceding better chances than we're creating, so therefore we're losing games. That's basically it.
Yeah, so we've had I think it was 22 shots against Everton, 15 of which were inside the box, but just a 27% accuracy. And you talk about the nervousness, you talk about the maybe not sure what to do. You know, look at these games against Wolf, Aston Villa, and Everton. Would you say, you know, fairly, you would have expected 6 points, both of you? Just a one-word answer, for example. Maybe out of
yes.
Games. Mikey, would you say yes?
I would have gone 4 or 5. That's
okay.
What I would have
let's
gone.
Go. Let's go to Everton and let's go 5. That puts us on 12 points, which would be level with Manchester United in 6th, which at this point of the season would be very, very respectable. But after 2 losses, it's that 3rd game where it then feels like we have to get something. And maybe that nervousness of not wanting to lose the ball is knowing that the turnovers are always dangerous. And, you know, we've expected 5, you push for 4, 5, maybe 4, and then you get nothing out of these 3 games, which is the time of the season where if you can get, you know, a good foothold, forget about the relegation zone. You're looking at the top 10, and that's where momentum breeds. You know, you look at Brighton and Hove Albion. Yes, they've lost Potter. They've just got a point at Anfield scoring 3 goals. Do you think that's a part of it, Jamie, that nervousness has come from maybe a lack of level in performance in the previous 2 games, knowing that they had to get something in this game, and then they couldn't do it?
It's the lack of experience as well, Harry, you're forgetting. You can see on Twitter, age of our squad. Yeah, it's showing the age of our squad because there's no experience in there anymore. You let go Ori and you bring in Maitland Niles. Don't wrong, that makes sense signing wise, but there's no wisdom in the squad. Prowse is what, 28? You shouldn't be expecting him to do that. You shouldn't be giving that all the wisdom because he hasn't really got the mindset to let go. Oh, you know what, boys? This happens all the time because he's never been in a squad that has performed, and kept the consistency. So you can't really then shirt to other players.
I think with Maitland-Niles, he's got the age, he's got the experience, he's played for England. I'm looking more at the players like Larios, for example, and like the 20-year-olds with less than 50 appearances. A couple of podcasts ago, we talked about the younger players and maybe people not overshadowing the experience, but, you know, a lot of them had 100, 150 games under their belt. But yeah, we went 1-0 up and everything was rosy. But within 4 minutes and 36 seconds, we were 2-1 down first. It was 1-1 immediately. We conceded a free kick. I think it was Damari Gray that launched the ball into the back post. Anana heads it across and Connor Cody's there to knock it in. Mikey, you're a set-piece man. You're an analyst. How and why, maybe, has Onana been allowed to just get a free run? No one's looking at his back, looking at his number. He gets a free run on our player, knocks it across. Cody scores. You know, it's a good set-piece goal from Everton, but it feels like an awfully basic one to concede from a Southampton point of view.
It's so naive. In my opinion, it is so naive because you're leaving Sekou Mara and James Ward-Prowse to deal with the man that every single aerial ball went to. I'm not joking on that either. Pickford kicked the ball left and right to the touchlines and Onana was there to pick it up. It's a tactic that Everton have because Onana is huge. Like he's not just like physically tall. He's physically strong as well. He's 6'2". He's a big lad. He throws his body around and you're letting Ward-Prowse, who's one of the shortest players on the pitch, and Sekou Mara, who's one of the skinniest players on the pitch, try and deal with that. And it's just not that... It doesn't make sense. I understand the fact that because it's zonal marking. That's what we always do from every set piece. We do zonal marking. And there are positives and negatives to doing man marking and zonal marking. But when you've got a player like Onana, you stick Belakotchap next to him and you do not let him have a free run at a ball. Because that's what, when teams defend with a high line, this is what teams are doing to counteract it, is they're sticking big men at the back post and nodding the ball back across goal. I don't know why teams don't do it more. It's a really effective way of doing it. I remember Villa did it when they beat Liverpool 7-2 in COVID, and I thought that's a brilliant tactic. More people are going to use that. And no one else seems to pick up on it. But like having a big man at the back stick, because a lot of people are zonal, a lot of people have their wingers or their fullbacks at the far post. And you look at our wingers and our fullbacks, they're not very big. So it's a tactic to be able to get round those sort of set pieces, is a floated ball to the back stick, knock the ball back across goal. It's really naive. It's really baffling to see it happen because we've conceded set pieces like this before, of like balls to the back stick to taller players. And yeah, it's infuriating because what we were ahead for about 2 minutes and we conceded a goal like that. And you sort of go, we worked so hard to break them down. And then all of a sudden, all of that's gone away because we couldn't get marking right on a set piece. Just like, oh, absolutely baffling.
I mean, you could probably look it up after, but the amount of goals we've conceded from crosses this season, and you could probably say the second goal that they scored was, it was from a cross, not even technically, it was from a cross as well. It's very infuriating. We went 2-1 down, but we were so close, it felt like, to getting an immediate leader again. You know, Aribo wins the ball. I think it was Tarkowski that played it out to him in what was a very strange drilled pass. He plays it to Adams, who took a touch. A lot of people saying maybe he should, maybe he shouldn't. That was blocked by Tarkowski. Then Armstrong had a shot, blocked. Ward-Prowse shot, blocked. It felt like one of those days, and they go up on the counter, they score on the other end. Jamie, do you think Bazunu could be doing better? I see a lot of people not really mention it at all. You know, he's absolutely blasted at McNeil at the near post. I, you know, don't have any expectation of him saving it. But maybe if it was McCarthy, there'd be more questions. What do you think of this whole Bazunu-McCarthy situation? Because there's a couple goals now where you could question it. The goal against Wolves, the winning goal against Aston Villa. What do you feel like on the whole situation?
I think he definitely gets off light because of the fact he's not Alex McCarthy. But I think the other goals you referenced there, Harry, I think, yeah, that's probably arguably should have saved those. However, when you smash a ball like that hard, you'd think as a, I don't know, obviously I'm no goalkeeper, but you think that's going over. Like, you see how Dwight McNeil just absolutely levers it. When that goes past you in the top bins, like, that's like the thing about how the angle it was as well. It's literally like the chance of that going in is so small. He just managed to place it perfectly, and Bazuna couldn't really do much about it. But I don't know. It's definitely a factor where he's not Alex McCarthy, and he gets aware of these mistakes a bit more because everyone's a bit more lenient with him because he's new and young. But that goal was a tough one because he did absolutely leather it into the top end.
I think also you can see from his like the way that he's dived, like the pattern of his diving. He's gone early because he thinks it's going to go across the goal. He thinks he's going to leather it back across goal, but he's gone for the near post and he's reacted late, and not got to it. So yeah, I think that's. It's to be fair, as a like if I was a goalie, I would have thought he's going to hit it back across goal because it's such a narrow angle. But he's gone for the near post and he's caught him out, and that's about it.
I mean, yeah, 66 shots after his previous goal, which I think was against Everton before he signed for them, he scores again. Bazunu so far, Mikey, I look at him. And I go, well, a lot of goalkeepers, he's at the age of 20. A lot of goalkeepers hit their prime, you know, 28, 29, 30. So we're a long time away from that. How do you feel like, do you think he's developed since he's come to us? How do you think he's settled in so far? Because he's not got a clean sheet, but I don't think he's been an obvious sticking point. You know, there's which goalkeeper is it so far? Danny Ward for Leicester, even though he had a good performance against Nottingham Forest, or David Button. For West Brom, both of them have had a struggling season since, you know, they've taken the number one shirt. For us, it doesn't seem that simple. It doesn't seem like he's been the number one reason. So his saving, but also his distribution, how have you felt so far?
I mean, like when you see him play, he's a lot happier outside of the box, which is what we signed him for, was to have a goalkeeper who can come out and make a decision and be good at it. So that bit you've seen, like quite often he'll come out off his line, nod a ball outside of the box, or he'll come off his line and look to play out and play as almost a sweeper at some time. So I don't think that's not a bad thing. He's done all right with that. And I was talking to, because one of our friends is a Smith supporter, and he was saying that when Bazunu was playing for Pompey, he had a really slow start and he sort of built up into it and got there. And I think it's just with everyone. We've got a new defence, new goalkeeper, once that's all sorted, hopefully soon. But once that's sort of put together and sorted, because again, you look at that back five that everyone says, like, you know, you need a settle back five, you need a back five that know exactly what each other's doing. All of them play together for the first time against Everton. Yeah. Like, it's a really, really new back five. Two of them were making their first starts for the club. One of them was making his debut. One of them was making his fifth appearance. Like, yeah, hopefully it will come together soon. And I think, yeah, I think it will. Because you can tell, like, each player has had their... I mean, Katlakar hasn't because he's only played one game. But I thought he was all right. I don't think he had a bad game. Each player can have, like, moments where you can pick out and go, okay, I see the quality there. I see the quality there. So if you turn around and go, right, if you can see that quality sort of build up, okay, we can use this. We can work with this. So, yeah, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, final question about this game before we sort of move on to the generic Arsenal sort of thing. And I'm going to send it to you, Mike, again, because, like I said, you're our analyst, and I'm hoping that you can give us answers to these questions. I did a bit of research myself, and between the 40th and 55th minute so far this season, we've either scored or conceded 9 goals. Rodrigo against Leeds in the 46th minute, Maddison 54th minute, Fernandez 55th minute. We scored one with Armstrong against Chelsea, 45 plus 1. Pedence 45 plus 1. Ramsey 41st minute. Aribo 49th, but then Cody 52nd, McNeil 54th, with Spurs being the only game so far without a goal in this sort of time period. So in and around the half time, you know, the 40 to the 55th, is there any sort of correlation that we could take from that? Or is it that I'm just spouting rubbish that just before half time, maybe, you know, we switch off just after half time, we're not completely turned on from coming out the tunnel. Is there anything we can gauge from that?
I think a lot of the goals you've mentioned there, quite a few of them have come from, well, I know the Podence one came from counter-attacks. One of the Everton ones came from a counter-attack, or it came from a set piece. So you think when you're late on and a half, or yeah, when you're late on and a half, you sometimes bomb bodies forward that you don't really need to, just to try and grab that goal before the half goes. So it may be the fact that we've bomb body forwards, they transitioned, we've given away a set piece, all of a sudden they've scored, or we've transitioned and we've transitioned poorly and they've scored just because we got that extra man forward that maybe we don't need. But no, that's it's a trend. You know, you can say that it's a trend if what is. Seven of those goals were against us, weren't they?
Yeah, seven.
Yeah. So, like, you can say, right, during the period just after half time, they don't start quickly. Well, by whatever means, whatever that means, or whatever they do in that 45 to 55 minute period, you then have to go, right, what is it that, who is the weak link? Who is the one that causes that? Or is it like a team thing? Is there something they do between that time? But that's a trend that you can start with going, right, we conceded seven goals during this time period. What's gone wrong? Why is that? Why is that the case? Because I know they bought out cones just before half time to do like a little warm up before going. So maybe that's the case that the players need to be switched on a little bit more when they come out the tunnel or whatever. Like, I don't know, maybe it's just something the players need. It's like literally just to put it up on the graph going, we conceded seven goals here. Why is that? Stop doing it. Basically, and that can just be the end
Yeah,
result of it. Like that could literally just be it. Like the analyst goes, look at that, stop making that happen and we'll lose less. But no, it definitely makes a change from conceding late goals, doesn't it? That's like, I don't know if it's better or worse. You
yeah,
know,
we
if
used to be to go ahead a lot of the time. Now, six of the eight games this season, we
we've gone
got behind,
behind, yeah.
which is utterly disappointing.
Yep.
I'm Sean Caleta-Carr. They both had chances, but it's another game that we've started well. I mean, you know, we've gone ahead, then we've lost. Now I'm going to play a little bit of a guessing game with you
Oh
two.
no.
I want you to guess how many points we've dropped from winning positions since Ralph Hasenhüttl took over. And you know what, Jamie, I'm going to go to you first. So from his first game, which I believe was Cardiff, you know, three and a half, 4 years ago, to now. How many
He's
points
like
have we got from winning positions?
62.
You've gone for 62. Mikey, how many points do you think we've lost from winning positions?
I thought I had a stat of like it was upwards of 70, so I'm gonna go 70.
92. We've lost
92.
92 positions, which is tw over 20 more than any other team in that time period, which is, you know, heavily, heavily disappointing. You know, you look at that, you look at his post-match comments. What do you feel about Ralph Hasenhüttl and his future, Jamie? Is he the man to take us forward? You know, all these signings, I look at it and, you know, before you say your opinion, I'm going to say that I think he should be given until the World Cup because then he's got, you know, a good time to blend the squad together, pick his favourite 11, see what's what. And then by that time, if it's not going well, we still have over half the season to change our fortunes around. So, what do you think of him, you know, as a character, but also, you know, the managerial ability and all of that stuff?
You stole my answer, Tizard. I said that to you yesterday. I cannot believe that. But yeah, I can wholeheartedly agree with you there, Harry. I think the people on Twitter, I understand why this answer on Twitter is annoyed and angry. However, when we had the new owners come in and all these big signings in summer, I felt it was a whole brand new chapter. It was like a new manager came in. Obviously, basically a whole new squad came in. That's what, like if it was any other manager at the start of the season, you know what, it's fine. It's, you know, he's a bump in the road, he's just learning. So is Ralph. He's learning his whole new squad he's got. You need to give him some time. Yes, it'll be a bit painful for now, but it's not like we're signing world beaters, is it? We're signing these young, hopefully talented players. He can't get instant results, unfortunately. Ralph needs to work with them, mould them how he wants them to play. And if it's not working by Christmas or World Cup, and yeah, I think Broad goes, yeah, that's fair enough. I'm sorry, Ralph, it's not going well. Get a new guy, and so he's got time to blend with the squad. He basically got a month off with a new manager coming in, which I think would be a perfect situation if we need Ralph to go.
Mikey, do you think it's the same? Because I think a lot of people have sort of said, you know, Ralph has taken us as far as he can. Now we need to move on, which, in all fairness, I don't think that's necessarily an insult. You know, you look at people like, I don't know, Gareth Southgate, for example. Maybe I feel, and maybe a lot of other people feel, that, you know, he's definitely improved, helped the transition, but someone else has to take over for England to win something. Or, you know, maybe club-wise, look at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, got them out of quite a bad period, took them as far as he could, and now they've got a manager to almost finish the project. That's sort of what, you know, Eddie Howe might be at Newcastle. When he takes them to a certain level, then they get Jose Mourinho, for example. Where do you stand on him? But also, where do you stand on his comments after the game and saying that, you know, it's another good performance and all that? But, you know, the first question and then the second.
Yeah, the future of Ralph Hasenhüttl is interesting, just because it always is. There's always some sort of peak and some sort of trough, and the trough always lasts longer than the peak and whatever. But I think, yeah, I think he's earned enough time to try and get this squad together. It's a long-term project on the fact that all of the signings that we've made are young. And I think at the moment, Ralph is going to be given time to the World Cup and maybe beyond the World Cup. It depends how many players go, I think. Like, if Ward-Prowse doesn't make this squad, how many people will go? Because Scotland haven't qualified, have they?
Nope.
So there's two that won't
Not
go. Bellicott-Chap probably won't go. Germany-wise, I don't know if Katlakar will go and play for Croatia. I don't know. But, like, there's... you've got a small selection of players that will actually leave, so that will give him nearly 3 months of a new pre-season to go and do what he needs to do. Well, a month and a half of a pre-season to basically do. I wouldn't be surprised if they go on one of those winter camps, you see, like just for 2 weeks or so to try and get them back into shape and just drill them and like work with them the entire day. But yeah, I'd stick with him. Because you can still see promises and stuff, like the promising stuff in the game and all that sort of stuff. And I think he's sort of been, we've been patient with him, but he's also been patient with the club, and sort of allowing the club to get into position where he can sort of manage in the way that he wants to with the players that he wants to. Because I remember us talking on the podcast maybe a year or two ago of going, well, this isn't Ralph's squad. He hasn't had the money to make the changes. This is now Ralph's squad. This is the squad that he's put together because we've had a turnover. We've had 10 players in over the last 6 months or so. So this is now Ralph's squad. This is the collective of players that he has now been put with, that now looks like he's wanted. And we're going to see how he does with them.
Yeah, and he's got the, you know, slightly difficult task of now playing Manchester City, who have steamrolled the Premier League so far. But I say that, they're still second, you know. Arsenal still leads the way, but I think Manchester City may just about win the league this season. And before we get on to why, who, where, and all that sort of stuff, I'm going to roll off a few stats that if Saints fans weren't scared before, they're going to be shivering in their boots now. 18 away games without a clean sheet for us. Manchester City have scored 28 goals in 8 games, which is the equal most, I think, in Premier League history of their last time. I think it was 17-18. They've scored a minimum of 3 goals in each of their last home games, and Haaland averages a goal every 48 minutes. Jamie, what do you think makes Haaland so dangerous in what is probably the tap-in question of the year? But also, did you expect him to be this good this early? Because I think a lot of people saw the projection and thought, you know, 20 goals this season, then he's going to dominate next year. And, you know, 20 goals isn't a bad return either. You know, Ings got 22 and it felt like he was scoring every week. Haaland's already on 15. So what do you think of them and especially him?
I don't think anyone knows Harry. He is on some sort of juju and no one knows what it is. It's like Roy Jennings said, he comes to the league, disrespects us by becoming the top goal scorer. It's an unthinkable question to think that Haaland can. It's an insult to the establishment, as he said.
I'm not going through this.
That was the most ludicrous thing ever. But
yeah.
I think Haaland is genuinely the most gifted footballer on this planet right now. And I think he's just the start of a new generation. He's Messi and Ronaldo's successor. And I just think, it's, unfortunately, he's just one in a lifetime good player. And I don't really know what to do about him. Because there's nothing you can really, apart from beat Bournemouth and be a solid defensive team.
Yeah, I mean, they lost 4-0. Somehow he only got...
still didn't score, is he?
Yeah, and he didn't score. He didn't score. He's now just got the 3 hat-tricks in a row at home. Mikey, how do we stop him?
I don't know. Just sort of, if we play 6 centre-halves and they just sort of run around him the entire game, then surely that will work. It's City... You basically went, right, City last year, you could sort of play a defensive block and you were okay. You could still play a high line because they didn't really play a number 9, so you were still all right then. Now, I don't know if you watched the analysis that Jamie Carragher did after the Man City Man United game, but it's quite funny because basically Erling Haaland does the two things that absolutely scare centre-halves, where he keeps looking in behind, so centre-halves will keep dropping off him, and that opens the entire midfield space for De Bruyne or Gundogan or Grealish or Foden to run through the centre of the pitch. And it just opens you up. And I'm very scared about that because we've seen Chelsea do that to us before and we lost 6-0, where they just opened up the centre of the pitch so much that we just couldn't cope. So if we are going to continue with a 4-4-2, I don't know what Ralph is going to do, but if we're going to continue with a 4-4-2, we need to make sure those two banks of four are really, really compact, really, really narrow, and just clutters the centre of the pitch. That's what you've got to make sure that you do, because you can't let De Bruyne or Grealish, to be fair, any of their attacking players, this includes like Jean Cancelo or Kyle Walker or whoever you want to play at your fullbacks at that point, you can't let any of them have time on the ball, like, or like the space to be able to pick that pass, because once they do, you're done. Like, you saw De Bruyne's pass for Haaland's first or second, no, second, because they scored the corner, didn't they? So Haaland's second, that pass, you give him that time, he can execute that any day of the week. Like, just easy. It's easy for him. Well, he's got 8 assists this season as well already, hasn't he?
Ridiculous.
Just insane. So that's like your main thing that you've got to try and do is stay compact and not let the midfield have any time. Which usually, like, if we play the 4-2-2-2, we can do that. We can compact the middle of the field quite easily. And then you've only got the problem of stopping Erling Haaland in the air, which again is an issue. So you just stick Bella Kotchap on him and hope he can deal with him. Fingers crossed. But yeah, you just got to shrug your shoulders and go, you just got to try your best. It's a one-off. You're not expecting to get anything out of it. If you do, it's amazing.
So what did Newcastle do so well then, Mikey, that, you know, helped them get a 3-3 draw? I know it's not a win, but getting 3 goals... I'm always saying only conceding 3 goals as well at this point, getting a point out of the game. I think they drew with Aston Villa as well, 1-1. What do these two teams do that sort of, not nullifies them, because they still scored, but allow them to get something out of a game that it almost seems impossible? It feels like at this point that they could go invincible. And I know that's early to say, but it's not impossible. Look at the way they've just dispatched teams left, right and centre.
I think you keep them wide. You keep them wide in areas where they don't want to be. City want to penetrate through the middle of the pitch. That's what they want to do. Like any team, they just want to penetrate through the middle of the pitch. So I think with that, you're looking at keeping a team in wide areas. Because in that 4-3-3, if you can keep Silva and Foden, the ball keep going to them, then that's what you got to do. Last year, both games against Man City, we drew them. We drew 0-0 and 1-1. And we did really well at marking Rodri out the game, because he's quite underrated in their midfield. He will dictate play quite easily, like, if you let him. He's like Fabinho in that way, where he will drop in front of the two centre backs and he will just spray passes left, right and centre, because he can do that and it's easy for him. So you've got to try and get Rodri out of the game. So you try and cut their build up out straight away. Like, don't even let the ball come up the pitch. You just got to cut Rodri out. You then have to try and keep the ball in wide areas to make yourself really compact. And what Villa did is they played, you remember the old Christmas tree formation? You got your four, your three, your two, your one. So yeah. You played two really narrow central midfielders, basically a 4-5-1. But they played five central midfielders. That's what they did. They played five central midfielders. Right. You are going wide. You are going nowhere near. You are going nowhere near the center of the pitch. You are just playing wide, and that's what they did. What Newcastle did, and what Newcastle spotted really well, was that when the fullbacks go forward, the center halves are they're still quite narrow. So when you break, you've got to break into wide areas. And you've got to use quick, pacey players to do that. So I think Adam Armstrong probably will start, and I think he'll be very effective in the game. If you can get Adam Armstrong chasing him behind into wide areas, so when you clear the ball, you want to clear the ball into wide areas, and hopefully Adam Armstrong will be able to sort of run into the channel, pick up the ball, and allow us to get out, because that's what Newcastle did with Saint-Maximin, of course, too. Very different players in Adam Armstrong being a bit more of a striker and wanting to be central and in the box and shooting, and Saint-Maximin being the dribbler that he is. So I'm sure Saint-Maximin found it easier to sort of retain the ball in that way. But all in all, two still very quick, very pacey players. So that's how Newcastle sort of broke City, was they got in behind a fullback and managed to make them turn and run at the defense, run at their own goal, which is something City aren't used to, is turning and running at their own goal. And of course, that's how we got the penalty as well at City's ground, which then got overturned for no reason whatsoever. But Adam Armstrong getting in behind Kyle Walker and making him run at his own goal, something that's not natural to him. So that's what you just got to do to City. You've got to be brave. You've got to be committed. You can't make a mistake. Once you make a mistake, you'll get punished. And you need luck on your side. You need Bazunu to have a really good game. You need the ball not to just plop to Haaland's feet in the box once a cross has been put in. You need luck. But yeah, that's what I would do to try and break down this Manchester City side.
Final question before we get into the score predictions. And normally, you know, the answer to this question would simply be a win or a point. But Jamie, what would you see as a positive for this game? Because we know even I am saying it's unlikely to get anything out of this game. And I normally say, you know, even these sort of games, a 0-0, a 0-1 to us. What would you see as a positive? A good performance, a better defensive play? Haaland only scoring twice, you know what?
Honestly, as long as we don't concede more than five or more than four, I'll be happy with the performance. I think if we go over five, then it's just, I don't know, but the number's too eerie for me to say that's a bad performance rather than 4-0. That's all right. We can live with that. But five, oof, you're getting too close to nine for comfort.
So you've
that's
said
what
that.
I worry about.
But what's your score prediction going to be for this game?
3-1, and Bazunu wants to prove himself, so he'll have a few good saves.
Would you take that right now, Mikey? And what's your score prediction?
We'll lose. I don't know how many by. Let's go four. And I saw a tweet from someone during the Manchester derby where they just went, right, on Saturday I'm going to turn the radio off, turn my phone off, go for a walk for 2.5 hours and just come back happy. Like that I think that's what some Southampton fans will do to try and get through the game, because it will be, if we're in it, it'll be stressful. If we're losing by a lot, it will just be depressing. So yeah, that's your balance on what will happen on Saturday.
Yeah, Gerard, I'm going to go for a 2-0 loss, which, it, in all fairness, probably feels like a win compared to, you know, what's happened to a lot of teams this season. And also it helps the goal difference that if we are stuck in a relegation battle, we don't have a -9 stuck to our name like a team like Bournemouth do, which you know, could impede them at the end of the season. Anyway, that's the end of this podcast. We've talked about the Everton game. We've discussed it all. set pieces, Ralph Hasenhüttl, the goals we've scored when we've conceded. And we've also talked about Manchester City. If you can, and if you're listening on Spotify, please, and I'll talk you through this, click on our name, just press the 5-star button or the 4-star button, or whatever you feel is correct. Let's get the number of reviews or star ratings up, if at all possible. Just as many as possible. It really, really does help us out. And maybe a review on Apple Podcasts, if you're listening there as well. We've enjoyed it once again. We hope that you have too. I'm Harry Tizard, and I've been joined by Mikey Maidment.
Goodbye.
Jamie Allen.
The cool kid. Goodbye.
And hopefully, Ollie Bose next week, where we can review a win, a draw, or not a damning defeat by Manchester City, as well as preview a game against West Ham. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.